Good morning, East Shore. Good morning. Happy Sunday. I hope you've had a good weekend thus far, and I'm excited to see you all here for our second book communion. We're going to learn together about what book communion is, so no worries if you don't already know or haven't already done this. You're going to be well indoctrinated by the end of the service.
Good morning. My name's Lassie Jordan. Oops, got cooked on my earring. Wrong choice of earrings. The book I'm going to be reading from is called A Thousand Names for Joy by Byron Katie, and I want to just tell you why. This is the book that I read after my husband died, and at the end of it, I knew that I would make it. I knew that I would live without him. Byron Katie's husband is named Stephen Mitchell, and he wrote one of the well-known translations of the Tao Te Ching, which is divided into 81 chapters. This book is also 81 chapters, and each is prefaced by a relevant line from the Tao Te Ching. This is from chapter 26. What I love about separate bodies is that when you hurt, I don't. It's not my turn. And when I hurt, you don't. Can you be there for me without putting your own suffering between us? Your suffering cannot show me the way. Suffering only teaches suffering. It's amazing how many people believe that suffering is proof of love. If I don't suffer when they suffer, they think, it means that I don't love them. How can that possibly be true? Love is serene. Love is fearless. If you're busy projecting your pain, busy projecting what someone's pain must feel like, how can you be fully present with them? How can you hold their hand and love them with all your heart as they move through their experience of pain? Why would they want you to be in pain too? Wouldn't they rather have you present and available? You can't be present for people if you believe that you're feeling their pain. Sadness is always a sign that you're believing a stressful thought that isn't true for you. It's a constriction and it feels bad. Conventional wisdom says differently, but the truth is that sadness isn't real, isn't rational. It isn't a natural response, and it can't ever help you. It just indicates the loss of connection with reality, the loss of the awareness of love. Sadness is the war with what is. It's a tantrum. You can experience it only when you are arguing with God. When the mind is clear, there isn't any sadness. There can't be. If you move into situations of loss in a spirit of surrender to what is, all you experience is a profound sweetness and an excitement about what can come from the apparent loss. And once you question the mind, once the stressful story is seen for what it is, there's nothing you can do to make it hurt. You see that the worst loss that you've ever experienced in your life is the greatest gift you can ever have. When the story arises again, he shouldn't have died, or she shouldn't have left me, it's experienced with a little humor, a little joy. Life is joy, and if you understand the illusion arising, you understand that it's you arising as joy.
Good morning. Hi, Nicole Duff. I use she, her pronouns, and I am your Director of Membership Development here at East Shore. Many think comic books and graphic novels are just about superheroes and action, but some authors and artists use this medium to portray real stories. Some include Mouse, which depicts the travesties of the Holocaust. They Called Us Enemies by George Takei shares his story of living in a Japanese internment camp. March by Senator John Lewis shares his stories of the many marches he took in his fight for civil rights. But today I'm going to read from Pride of Baghdad, which is a graphic novel by Brian K. Vaughan and Nico Hencheron. It tells the true story of a pride of lions struggling to survive on the streets of Baghdad following an American bombing. The book has received accolades for the portrayals of civilians who find themselves in the middle of a war with the concept of freedom. The book follows the lions just freed from the zoo and experiencing what was beyond the cages for the first time. We're going to start where we find the young cub and a lioness who've only known life in a zoo. And the pictures are up there because a graphic novel is visual and meant to be read with the photos. All right. Get the hell away from my tigress. Huh? I'm not a tigress. I'm a lion, and I certainly don't belong to you. Tigris is the name of the river, dummy. Rivers have names? Everything's got a name. It's how we make crap belong to us. And this stretch of crap is my fishing hole. Calm yourself, turtle. We're just here to drink. Really? In that case, be my guest. Maybe you'll scare away the goddamn hawksbills. I don't remember hearing about any of your kind living in the zoo. Zoo? I'm no cage dweller lady. Why, that were you two busted out of? Yeah, the sky fell on our old house. Hell, not again. This has happened before? More than once. Last time was a dozen or so years ago. A dozen? How old are you? I hatched during the first big war, back when the sinkhole was an empire. First war? Listen, my people and I haven't been here nearly as long as you. What's this all about? It's about losing your wife, your kids, every worthless friend you've ever made. How'd they get lost? There's black stuff under the earth, boy. Poison. When the walkers fight, they send it spewing into the sky and spilling into the sea. Walkers? You mean the keepers? Keepers, two-leggers, man? Doesn't matter what you call them. They're all the same. What are they fighting about? Damned if I know, son. Damned if I care.
Hello, my name is Claire Weichselbaum. My pronouns are she, her, hers, and I will be reading some excerpts from the introduction of For Small Creatures Such as We, Rituals for Finding Meaning in Our Unlikely World by Sasha Sagan, who is the daughter of Carl Sagan. Being alive was presented to me as profoundly beautiful and staggeringly unlikely, a sacred miracle of random chance. My parents taught me that the universe is enormous, and we humans are tiny beings who get to live on an out-of-the-way planet for the blink of an eye. And they taught me that, as they once wrote, quote, "For small creatures such as we, the vastness is bearable only through love." Growing up in our home, there was no conflict between science and spirituality. My parents taught me that nature, as revealed by science, was a source of great, stirring pleasure. Logic, evidence, and proof did not detract from the feeling that something was transcendent. Quite the opposite. It was the source of its magnificence. Beneath the specifics of all our beliefs, sacred texts, origin stories, and dogmas, we humans have been celebrating the same two things since the dawn of time, astronomy and biology. The changing of the seasons, the long summer days, the harvest, the endless winter nights, and the blossoming spring are all byproducts of how the Earth orbits the sun. The phases of the moon, which have dictated the timing of rituals since the dawn of civilization, are the result of how the moon orbits us. Birth, puberty, reproduction, and death are the biological processes of being human. Throughout the history of our species, these have been the miracles, for lack of a better word, that have given us meaning. They are the real, tangible events upon which countless celebrations have been built, mirroring one another even among societies who had no contact. As I see it, here we are on this rock, that orbits a star in a quiet part of a spiral galaxy somewhere in the great, wide vastness of space and time. On our rock, these events, changes, and patterns have an enormous impact on us Earthlings. They are important to us. We've spent a lot of time trying to decode them, to manage our expectations, to predict what's coming, to grow, to thrive, to survive. No matter where or when on Earth we live, we humans tend to schedule our most important events around these same times. And it's not just certain times of the year, it's times of life too. Every culture, from the Amish to the Maasai, has coming-of-age rituals that, at their core, are the same as any bar mitzvah, quinceañera, or sweet 16 you've ever been to. Not to mention the vast array of human ways to welcome a newborn, marry a couple, or honor the dead. Ecstatic joy to deepest sorrow, the heart of these rituals lies beyond belief. While our calendars have shifted and our climates, politics, and superstitions vary, somewhere in the depths of whatever you celebrate, there is very likely a kernel of some natural occurrence. We needn't resort to myth to get that spine-chilling thrill of being part of something grander than ourselves. Our vast universe provides us with enough profound and beautiful truths to live a spiritually fulfilling life. Nature is full of patterns, and we humans love finding them, creating them, repeating them. That's at the core of language, math, music, and even ritual, which is the repetition of words or actions deemed worthy of representing something bigger than ourselves.
Hello, my name is Ron Douglas. I go by pronouns he, him, his. Today, I'm going to be reading an excerpt and also giving a bit of history on Juneteenth. This book is actually called On Juneteenth, and it is written by the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Annette Gordon Reed. And again, the book is called On Juneteenth. It's a small, quick read, about 130 pages. Strongly suggest pick it up, take a look. And one of the reasons I wanted to do this, and another reason why I also love attending this church, is because we're all really open to education and learning the differences among those of us that make up these United States of America. So On Juneteenth weaves together American history, dramatic family chronicle, and searing episodes of memoir, providing a historian's view of the country's long road to Juneteenth, recounting both its origins in Texas and the enormous hardships that African Americans have endured in the century since, from Reconstruction through Jim Crow and beyond. All too aware of the stories of cowboys, ranchers, and oil men that have long dominated the lore of the Lone Star State, Gordon Reed herself, a Texas native and the descendant of enslaved people brought to Texas as early as the 1820s, forges a new and profoundly truthful narrative of her home state with implications for us all. The excerpt that I wanted to read was just to give you a taste of some of the things that are in it. So, Bob White had come to Livingston, Texas, the town where I was born, at the request of his mother, who wanted him to help her pick cotton on a place that was still called a plantation. In 1936, he was accused of raping Ruby Cochran, a white woman in town. The authorities brought about 15 black men who were working on the cotton field to have Cochran identify the man who raped her. She could not identify her attacker by sight, but she ultimately identified White by his voice. After the authorities had him speak words she had confidently told them the assailant had said during the assault. After being arrested and put in jail, the Texas Rangers took White into the woods nightly for a week, chained him to a tree, beat him severely, and threatened to kill him if he did not confess. They prepared a statement for him to sign, though he could neither read nor write. During this initial period, he had no lawyer and was not allowed to speak with anyone. He was found guilty in the first trial and sentenced to die in an electric chair. The case was appealed, and a new trial was ordered. This time, the trial was removed to Conroe, Texas, because the atmosphere in Livingston was simply too charged. White was convicted again. The case went all the way up to the Supreme Court of the United States. Writing for the court in 1941, Justice Hugo Black held that the confession attained by severe beatings and keeping White incommunicado violated the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. With that, the case went back down for retrial. It was during the final proceedings in Conroe in June of 1941 that W.S. Cochran, Ruby Cochran's husband, walked to the front of the courtroom and shot White in the back of the head. He was arrested and was out on bond of $500. His trial, held a few days later, lasted 3 hours. After the prosecutor's closing statement, the courtroom erupted in applause and cheers. The jury deliberated for 2 minutes and returned a verdict of not guilty. And Cochran walked out of court a free man after having murdered Bob White in an open courtroom in front of the judge, lawyers, and dozens of spectators. So what I wanted to do was just read that little excerpt, but what I really wanted to do was to also give you a little bit of history on Juneteenth and why it's a holiday today. Juneteenth is known to some of the United States as the country's second Independence Day, observed each year on June 19th. The holiday marks the end of slavery in Texas at the end of the Civil War. For more than 150 years, African-American communities across the country have observed this holiday, from social gatherings in emancipation parks to church services and other events. But Juneteenth has increasingly become celebrated nationwide, and in 2021, it became the first new federal holiday since the establishment of Martin Luther King Jr. Day in 1983. So what does Juneteenth actually celebrate? At the stroke of midnight on January 1st, 1863, the Emancipation Proclamation came into effect and declared enslaved people in the Confederacy free on the condition that the Union won the war. The proclamation turned the war into a fight for freedom, and by the end of the war, 200,000 black soldiers had joined the fight, spreading news of freedom as they fought their way through the South. Since Texas was one of the last strongholds of the South, emancipation would be a long time coming for enslaved people in the state. Even after the last battle of the Civil War was fought in 1865, a full 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation was signed, it is believed that many enslaved people still did not know that they were free. As the story goes, some 250,000 enslaved people only learned of their freedom after Union General Gordon Granger arrived in Galveston, Texas on June 19th, 1865, and announced that the president had issued a proclamation freeing them. On that day, Granger declared, "The people of Texas are informed that in accordance with a proclamation from the executive of the United States, all slaves are free. This involves an absolute equality of personal rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves, and the connection heretofore existing between them becomes that between employer and hired labor." With Granger's announcement, June 19th, which would eventually become known as Juneteenth, became a day to celebrate the end of slavery in Texas. As newly freed Texans began moving to neighboring states, Juneteenth celebrations spread across the South and beyond. Early Juneteenth celebrations included church services, public readings of the Emancipation Proclamation, and social events like rodeos and dances. For decades, many Southern black communities were forced to celebrate Juneteenth on the outskirts of town due to racism and Jim Crow laws. To ensure they had a safe place to gather, Juneteenth groups would often collectively purchase plots of land in the city on which to celebrate. These parks were commonly named Emancipation Parks, many of which still exist today. As the civil rights movement gained momentum in the 1960s, Juneteenth celebrations faded. Only in recent years, however, Juneteenth has regained popularity and is often celebrated with food and community. It also has helped raise awareness about ongoing issues facing the African American community, including a political fight for reparations or compensation to the descendants of victims of slavery. So again, as part of an education or a bit of homework, I should say, the book is On Juneteenth, written by the Pulitzer Prize winner Annette Gordon Reed. It's a quick read, it's a good read, and I wouldn't say, I'm a firm believer of there's three sides to every story. There's one side, there's the other side, and there's the truth. I suggest that we've all heard the one side, get to know the other side. Thank you.
Good morning. That was fun. Look at all that. My name is Mike Radow. I use he, him pronouns. I'm going to read from A Tale for the Time Being. You are all time beings in this book. The narrator of this piece is a teenage Japanese-American girl who has trouble struggling between her two cultures. She's gone to spend a summer with her Buddhist monk grandmother. They're looking at the ocean and the surfers. The waves keep beating them up, too. Jiko squinted, but she couldn't see them through the flowers, through her flowers of emptiness. There, I said, see that one? He's just standing up. He's up. He's up. Oh, he's down. I laughed. It was funny to watch. Jiko nodded like she was agreeing with me. Up, down, same thing, she said. It's a typical Jiko comment. All about pointing to what she calls the not-to nature of existence, when I'm just trying to watch some cute guy surfing. I know better than to argue with her because she always wins, but it's like a knock-knock joke where you have to say who's there so the other person can tell you the punchline. So I said, no, it's not the same thing, not for a surfer. Yes, she said, you're right, not same. She adjusted her glasses. Not different either. See what I mean? It is different, Granny. The whole point of surfing is to stand on top of the wave, not underneath it. Surfer, wave, same thing. I don't know why I bother. That's just stupid, I said. A surfer's a person. A wave is a wave. How can they be the same? Jiko looked out across the ocean to where the water meets the sky. A wave is born from deep conditions of the ocean, she said. A person is born from deep conditions of the world. A person pokes up from the world and rolls along like a wave until it's time to sink down again. Up, down, person, wave. She pointed to the steep cliffs along the shoreline. Jiko, mountain, same thing. The mountain is tall and will live a long time. Jiko is small and will not live much longer. That's all. Like I said, this is pretty typical of the kind of conversation you have with my old Jiko. I never completely understand what she's saying, but I like that she tries to explain it to me anyway. It's nice of her. And I didn't bring that book. I got it from the library. I wanted to mention and thank you, Ron. What stood out in your story, among many things, was that literacy is a privilege and freedom, not just to be able to read, but to choose what to read, is always under attack. So thank you for all your readings today.
Good morning. I'm Bruce Dodge, and today for the benediction, I'd like to read a poem from my sister Marie's book, Liquid Moon. Come. Come all seeking forgiveness for broken vows. Come carrying your baskets of despair. Together we will praise the change and make a resting place to repair the world. Come all scanning the horizon for a sign whose boats are moored along the shore. Together, we will praise the change and set sail into a new day. Come, all longing for balance and rest. Come holding your wounded heart in your hand. Together we will praise the change and weave a blanket of solace and consolation. Come, stand in love's forge to melt in golden wonder. Together we will praise the change and peace broken bitter shards of faith and longing into a new whole. Come.